This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 282.
Hey folks, it's Trevor and Angie here. We are actually sitting in a hotel room. We just left the London Marathon 2 days ago. We had a fantastic time in London. The marathon was great. We saw a lot of our friends and listeners there, and we look forward to telling you guys all about it in episode 283. And we are actually sitting in a hotel room in Iceland right now, of all places, Reykjavik, Iceland, on our way back to the US. So we just got a quick episode here. We want to play an interview we did with Martin Dugard. He's author of the book To Be a Runner, which is a series of essays which takes the reader around the world as he recounts his personal journey through the world of long-distance running. And he really had a lot of interesting experiences in his life, including running with the bulls in Spain, one of Angie's new bucket list goals. Right, Angie?
I think people know me better than that.
Yeah, Angie's like the safest person I know. Like, doesn't even leave the house without a helmet on, right? Okay, that was the sound of an eye roll. It's been a long day. We've been traveling, and now we're in a hotel room, and Angie has spent the last 7 days nonstop with me in tiny spaces. So anyway, we're having a good time. But yeah, we wanted to play this interview for you guys, and we'll get back home and put together our epic race recap. Cool thing about Martin, he also has written books about explorers like David Livingstone and Christopher Columbus, quite a wide-ranging author. His work has appeared in Esquire, Outside Magazine, Sports Illustrated, and GQ. And he's also a New York Times bestselling author and co-author of the Killing series, Killing Lincoln, Killing Kennedy, and so forth, which have sold over 15 million books. So one of the questions I will ask him is, what's harder, to write a book or to run a marathon? And you guys can hear his answer of how those two things are kind of related. Martin lives in Orange County, California, and he coaches a local high school cross-country team there. And by the way, you will hear him mention a adventure race called the Raid Galois. This is actually a multi-day, multi-event race that takes place all over the world. And it was originally named, I just looked it up, it was originally named after the Galois Cigarette Company, which sponsored the race when it began back in the 80s. So a little context for you when he talks about the raid. So that's what's going on with this episode. We did a bit of walking around today, but Angie, one thing you said to me was, it doesn't even feel like I ran a marathon 2 days ago.
Yeah, I was a little bit achy yesterday. And of course, our legs were tired because we walked all around London yesterday and saw the last minute sights. But today I had like totally forgotten that I had run a marathon 2 days ago. I was going up and down stairs and just feeling normal. So yeah, that was awesome.
Well, I can still feel it. I will have you know.
Well, I'm glad one of us can.
It's a good kind of feeling, though. It's like this stiffness and soreness that reminds me of what I just did. So it's a good kind of, man, I'm glad I did that soreness, I think. All right, so let's go ahead and play our interview with Martin Dugard, author of the book To Be a Runner. It's an interesting read because it's not like one of those how-to books, you know, where it's got training plans and stuff in it. It's more of like a philosophical journey through the world of running and what it has meant to Martin through the years. And I think it's pretty down to earth. Like he's not afraid to be self-deprecating in the book. I don't know, Angie, what did you think of the book?
Yeah, it was a great read. I think listeners will really just be nodding their heads as they listen to it or read it.
All right, so we're going to play this conversation with Martin Dugard. Then when it's done, we'll jump back on and we have a question that we'll answer from our Facebook page from a guy who wants to run his first marathon in 2020 and just wants to know where to start. So stay tuned for that. After the interview is over, here's our conversation with Martin Dugard. Well on my way, well on my way. Well, we're on the podcast now with Martin Dugard, author of the book To Be a Runner. Martin, it's an honor to have you on the MTA podcast.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So take us back to the beginning. How did this book come to be? And maybe if you want to go further back than that, how did you get into running?
Well, I'll start with the running story. So when I was 6 years old, my dad read the book Aerobics by Kenneth Cooper, very seminal mid-1960s thing that basically advocated running. It was the follow-up to Bill Bowerman's jogging book. And so he became a runner, and so I would go to the base gym. He was an Air Force pilot. I'd go to the base gym and watch him run 10 laps around the basketball floor for his mile. And one day I just decided to try it myself. So I ran a mile. I was, you know, like I said, 6 years old. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. So that was kind of my go-to. I mean, if you're an introverted or very small kid, running is a really good way to kind of do your jam, and not, you know, especially if you're not good at baseball, basketball, or football. So I began running competitively when I was 11. I ran all the way. I was all state in two different states, California and Michigan, in track and cross country in high school. Then I ran competitively at Northern Michigan University. And then, you know, there was really, back then, there really wasn't much of a post-collegiate world. Either you were an Olympian or you were not. So recognizing that there was really no future as a runner, I just stopped running. And what happens when you stop running and you have eaten and drank your whole life like a runner, you get 4 years later, I thought I'd come back to it. And I did. And it was great. I kind of immersed myself in triathlon and marathons. And, you know, I run New York, I run Boston, I run LA. I ran the Disneyland Marathon. But my first marathon was 17. I ran a 2:57 at what is now the Napa Valley Marathon. But I went through that phase a lot of runners do, where you kind of do that achievement running, where everything had to get longer and longer. So it wasn't enough just to do a triathlon. It had to be a longer triathlon. It wasn't enough just to do a triathlon. I had to do adventure races. And then it was not just the 6-hour adventure race. It was the 2-week Raid Gauloise adventure race, you know, in different foreign countries.
Can I ask a quick question? Sorry to interrupt. Can you just tell us, what listeners, real quick, what that was?
Yeah, there's an American version called the Eco Challenge, which is actually making a comeback this year. But it was a 2-week race held in a different foreign country every year. You had a 5-person team. Each team had to have at least one woman. So and it was all human powered locomotion. Well, mostly there was horseback riding, but it was, you know, running, kayaking, rock climbing, rappelling. 1 year it was skydiving. And it usually took, you know, you basically had to carry all your own food and water. You slept about an hour a day, and it went, like when I finished the raid in Lesotho in 1997, it was 11 days, I think 11 days, 12 hours or something like that. I mean, it was just nonstop.
Wow.
So super cool, high burnout sport. Just you can't sustain that very long. But what happened was I was going to do the raid in Patagonia 1 year. And I remember just before the starting line, not wanting to go spend the next 2 weeks climbing through the mountains of Patagonia. And all I wanted to do was go back and be a runner again. I thought if I could do anything right now, I would just go back and just be a runner, which is what I did. I kind of hung it up after that race. So running, you know, I kind of dabbled in ultras like a lot of people do. Then I kind of made my way back to just running. I loved trail run. I mean, I've competed for so many years that the idea of competition kind of lost its luster. So now I get my competitive stuff by the teams that I coach. So I've coached at high school cross country and track for the last 14 years. We've got 6 state champions, hoping to get a couple more this year. And so that's my competitive side. My daily run now is a great trail run. And I live 500 meters from local trailhead. So it's beautiful here.
So after you did all those ultra races, and then you said, I just want to return back to normal running. I mean, why did that occur? What didn't get satisfied, like, in your soul by all those, like, going bigger and faster and all those races?
I think what happens, and I think a lot of people eventually go through it, at some point when you realize you're not going to win the Olympic gold medal, which is kind of what all of us kind of wish we could do. I mean, and a very small group. So what we do is we do that achievement thing where we try to go, you know, more races, you know, more marathons, longer races. And what you find at some point is, I think in and of itself, that is not satisfying. You might as well just do it because you really love to do it. What I really love about running is just getting out there and just running because it's good enough in and of itself for me. I don't need to say that I just ran a 50K or I just ran another Raid Gauloise. Matter of fact, I was asked to go compete in this year's Eco Challenge, and I actually thought about it and you know, it would take an enormous amount of work to get myself in that kind of condition. And at the end of the day, I thought that would be cool, but why? You know, I've done that. Why go back and do it again just to tell people I'm doing it? So I think running in and of itself needs to become more of an issue with a lot of people. I think so many people just want to say that they did 1,000 marathons and, you know, 50 triathlons. And at the end of the day, you've got to connect with the people around you. You've got to connect with yourself in some kind of way. And that's what I get out of running.
I think you really unspool that really well in the book with your various essays, because, you know, you see your various journeys, you know, the first time that you're a runner and the competitive edge, and you know, the second time and the third time. And I think many listeners will relate to that, because for a number of reasons, a lot of people did run when they were younger and they were competitive, and they got to that place where they weren't getting PRs anymore. And, you know, they kind of fell off from running. Or a lot of people have gone through periods of injury. And so, you know, I really like how you're talking about it has to be deeper than going faster, going farther all the time. It has to be about having that joy and love of running to keep you going long term.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, let's face it, there's a lot of benefits we get out of running, you know. But I think the greatest thing is that peace of mind you get when, you know, when you get on the trail and you've had a really rough, busy day, then within 5 minutes, every problem you have just kind of seems to go away. You know, and I talk in there in the book about how when runners get together, we talk about things as a group on the run that you would never share in casual conversation. You know, people and talk about their love lives and their fears and their hopes and their ambitions. And you just don't do that in casual conversation, but there's something confessional about running that allows people to do that.
Yeah, you're right. I've talked to people in a race, you know, and just after a couple minutes of talking back and forth, you know, they're sharing how they're doing this because they lost their brother, and this is a cathartic experience for them. And you just don't have those kind of casual conversations, you know, in real life. It's usually pretty surface.
So let's talk about your book. I want to get to that in just a minute, though. But first question is, what's harder, to write a book or to run a marathon?
I don't know. You know, I have to, you know, I have a confession to make. I mean, I've run almost 24 marathons. I never really took to the marathon. I always get to that point halfway through where it's like, oh, great, I just ran 13 miles. Oh, I have 13 more. And it's just...
Yep.
I think we can relate to that.
I remember I ran Boston 1 year, and I had like 104-degree fever at the start, and I thought, I just want to finish. And wow. I got to Wellesley, and I thought, this is great. I feel good, but it's like I have all these hills in front of me. And it just, you know, that suffering. Well, that's what it's like halfway through a book. You know, if you're writing an 80,000 to 100,000 word book, you get to that point at about the 40,000 word mark where all of a sudden you go, great, I wrote 40,000 words. I got 150 pages in the book. We still have a long way to go. And it's like, you know, continue that marathon analogy. The last, you know, 6 miles of a marathon are always the worst. I mean, I've lost so many minutes, especially the last 2 miles, just because of slowing down, my body shutting down. Well, it's the same way with the end of a book. You get to that point where you only have like 10,000 words left, which is about 50 pages. And there's something about that that just, instead of, you know, rocketing through, you know, just like making those 50 pages go by fast, it seems like they come like 100 words at a time, 100 words a day at a time. It's the most frustrating feeling, because all you want to do is finish it and give it to the publisher so you can, you know, get that mental health break.
You want to finish strong, you want to finish fast, but like everything is working against you.
Yeah, exactly. You want to be able to kick at the finish, and there's a, it's when you come limping across the finish line.
Except at the end of a marathon, no one says, oh, you got to go do it over.
You got to go edit.
Yeah, it's true. But you know, I like the editing process a lot. I mean, it's a great feeling to get that first pass of the manuscript done and to give it off. But when people, you know, I'm not normally a collaborative person, but that part of the book where people come back and they say, you know, what if we move this from chapter 1 to chapter 4? Or, you know, what if we did this and did this and this? And then when you start making those changes and you start working together to make it better, it kind of grows, and it's, you know, it's pretty cool.
And remind me, how many in the Killing series have been sold?
We're over 15 million.
That's so amazing.
Yeah. So, I should tell you, I got my start as a writer because I graduated from college, and after 7 glorious years of college, I had a good time in college. And I got this corporate job, and at the time I was just doing a lot of 5Ks and duathlon, you know, the run, bike, run. And within a week, I knew I was not cut out for the corporate world. And ever since I was a kid, I'd had this passion for writing and for reading. But my mother had told me, I remember this when I was very young, I said, I want to be a writer. And she said, well, don't be silly. Writers don't make any money. And so I banished that thought from my head until I was, you know, 25 years old, and I was just miserable. And I literally went to see a career counselor. She had me take all these tests. And she said, have you ever thought about being a writer? And so all these years later, so while I was working my corporate job for 5 years, I started writing for running and triathlon magazines. So Competitor Magazine here in Southern California, kind of worked my way up the food chain to, you know, Runner's World and Sports Illustrated and Outside and Esquire. And then one day when I was at work, I got a call from this guy, Mark Burnett, who is the producer of The Apprentice and Survivor and The Voice. And at the time, he didn't have two pennies to rub together, but he was taking a team of Navy SEALs to Madagascar to compete in this adventure race. And he wanted to know if I would come and write about his team. And crazy enough, and I went home and told my wife, she said, that sounds like a great idea, but you've been waiting 5 years for that call. It's not going to come again. So I took off for 3 weeks and went to Madagascar to write about the Navy SEALs and that race, which was the Raid Galois, the one that I later went on to compete in. When I came back from that trip, my boss fired me the first day back. And I went to my wife, and it was 25 years ago in February, February 24th, 25 years ago. She said, look, if you want to be a writer, make it work. You know, don't look for another job. You know, we had two kids at the time. She said, just make it work. And so from magazines to books to, you know, I covered the Tour de France for 10 years. And, you know, it just kind of built and built and built. And 25 years later, here we are.
As someone who works in a creative profession like you do, talk about the role that running has had in, you know, sparking your creativity, giving you ideas. And I think people who are not in creative professions necessarily will probably be able to relate.
Well, you know, I've got the luxury that a lot of people don't, is that if I get stuck, like if I'm writing and I hit a problem, there are two things you can do. You can sit here and I can kind of beat it over the head, or I can, you know, run 500 meters down to the trail. And if I go left, it takes me towards Saddleback Mountain, which is about 10 miles away. And if I go to the right, it takes me to the Pacific Ocean, which is also 10 miles away. And so the amount of problem solving that takes place during those runs, and very often when you're writing something, you kind of have to get out of your own way, as a lot of writers say. In other words, you have a problem, but you kind of imagine that there's a critical thinking parent looking over your shoulder, or there's a part of you that doesn't believe you can write as well as you think you can, or take that risk and make a statement on the page that you might not ordinarily do. And there's something about running. If you get out there and you run, and sometimes it takes, you know, 3 miles. This morning I went out for 30 minutes, and it just kind of fixed a lot of stuff that needed to be fixed on the new manuscript. So it's restorative. And as a creative person, to be able to go off like that, and especially, like I said, with the trails. And there's a place called Chiquita Ridge here. I live in Rancho Santa Margarita, Southern California. It's 600 meters to the top of the hill from the trailhead. But when you get to the top and you start winding down there, the whole world just seems to open up. And so, like I said, creatively, that's a luxury I have that a lot of people don't have. But just to be able to do that makes a lot of difference.
Yeah, definitely. So how did the book To Be a Runner come to be?
So back in 2007, when the economy completely collapsed, there was nothing. I couldn't sell a book to save my life. And I, you know, at the time I was writing a lot about history and exploration. So basically I took a gig ghostwriting the autobiography of a very unhappy billionaire. He's not living anymore. So it's it was fun. I mean, I got to fly in his private jet, and we would go to London. We would, you know, do interviews in New York, all around the world. I had all this time because he was wealthy. I was kind of like the writing servant. You know, he would go out and play golf, and I'd be beckoned at the end of the day to do an interview. So I would have all this time to myself. And I had a deal with my agent at the time that I would never, ever write a running book, because running books kind of fall into a couple of categories. There's kind of the how-to running book, or there's kind of the George Sheehan Running and Being type book. And I wanted to find a way to write something similar to that. But my agent and I just had this deal. He goes, look, they don't sell. But for some reason, I had to get it out of me. And so I had all this time working with this guy. So I challenged myself to write one essay a day for 30 days. And so that's what I did. Some were 500 words long, some were 1,000 words long, some were 2,000 words long. You know, at the end of 30 days, I took all those essays, and because it was a lifetime of thought about running. And you know, you do the same thing too. You're out on the trail, you have a thought, you go, man, I wish I got it. I'd like to write that down. I'd like to save it so, you know, my kids can see it, or my distant relations, or, you know, something you want to share. And that's what I did. I wrote down all these thoughts, and I put them just on paper. I finally put them on paper after a lifetime of thinking about them. And then I edited them. I cleaned them up. I took out all the snarky stuff, all the, you know, the digs you want to make at people, you know. But then I took the whole package, I condensed it, and I never do this because we're in this digital age, but I literally printed the whole thing out. I tied it up in a red ribbon, put it in a box, and I FedExed it to my agent just as a complete manuscript. And I said, look, if you don't like it, throw it away. Forget that I wrote it. I've got it for my, you know, for posterity. If you like it, try to sell it. And he liked it. So here we are.
So, but he originally told you that running books don't sell very well.
Yeah, he has a good point, because like I said, if if you're going to write a running book, you've got to do something really outside the box, like Born to Run, which kind of came out of nowhere for people. Mm-hmm. Or just go the really conventional route and, you know, write the Couch to 5K type book. So for aspirational runners or for people who, you know, I don't know. I mean, you can't see my office, but I've got stacks. My office is a mess because I just finished a book, but I've got literally stacks of training books, you know, stuff like Running with the Buffaloes.
Yeah.
All these, but the thing about them is that they fit a very small niche market, and right. I wanted to write something that kind of transcended just the running market and hopefully uplifted people. I mean, it really is. It's a love letter to running. That's what the book is. It's just something I've been passionate about for more than 50 years, and to have the chance to write about it and get it published is a complete blessing.
One of the things I loved about it was that you kind of wove in the spiritual part of running, how being out there connecting with nature and pushing yourself in different ways can really, you know, help you connect with, you know, God or higher power or whatever, you know, it is a person believes in.
Well, I allude to it a little bit in that essay about competition, but I think, you know, I think one of the reasons we get uplifted, for instance, when we watch greatness in anything, but, you know, let's take the Olympics for example, when somebody watches a Michael Phelps or a Mo Farah do something that is so beyond what we are capable of doing, but it seems like the ultimate level of human power. I think that's why we get so inspired by that. And that's what we all aspire to ourselves. And I think that every day when we go out to run, we're just trying to be just that little bit better. And I think what happens is that process of always trying to be a little bit better brings us more to the ideal of, whether it's, you know, you call it God or whatever you want to call it, that's the ideal we were created to be, which is the best version of ourselves. And I think that, you know, it's not pretty. You know, running is, we get blisters, we get sore. But, you know, the fact that we push through that and that we aspire to be better instead of just saying, oh, you know, that's good enough for me. And a lot of people do that. A lot of people, hey, you know, I played high school football. You know, for the rest of their life, that was their glory days. And I think when you're a runner, and if you continue running, you make your own glory days for the rest of your life. And as long as you keep taking that first step out the door.
I like it. Maybe I would be interested in exploring some other ways that running makes us better and makes the world better. The subtitle of the book is How Racing Up Mountains, Running with the Bulls, or Just Taking on a 5K Makes You a Better Person and the World a Better Place.
I need to start by saying that the publisher wrote the subtitle 10 years ago, and I hated it then, and I hate it.
Okay.
What would you subtitle it if you had to?
Good question.
Do it over again.
It just, because the fact that we have how-to in the thing, I feel like it's a little bit misleading. I think a lot of people originally bought the book thinking there was going to be workout programs and diet programs, and it's not that kind of how-to. It's more like a metaphysical how-to. So ways that running makes you better. I mean, that's the great thing I love about coaching, because every day I get out there, my runners expect me to know exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it. And, you know, and I've got runners of all levels. I mean, I've got two guys right now that are 9-minute 2-milers. And then I've got some kids right now who can't run 9 minutes for 1 mile. And so you have to coach to all levels of abilities and try to inspire all levels of ability. And the great thing about that is, even though I'm not actually doing the running with them, it makes me a better person, because just by kind of trying to get inside their heads, it kind of forces me to intellectualize the process and encourage them and inspire them and challenge them to be better. And that look when they run a great race, when they do something they didn't think they could do, is phenomenal. It's kind of like a lot of coaches call coaching a gateway drug, because when you help somebody else do something they did not know they're capable of doing, it is a phenomenal feeling.
I think, and the thing is, you know, when you dedicate yourself to being a lifelong runner, even if a person considers themselves middle of the pack, you just never know who's watching, seeing your consistency day in and day out, you know, and they can see, even if you don't talk about your running or brag about it, that, you know, you are pushing yourself to be a better person. And, you know, I think we've got 3 boys as well, and our youngest is named Liam, which is kind of cool, but they're really not interested in distance running at this point. But just that modeling as a parent, I think, is so important.
I think so too. I mean, and it's, they're always watching us no matter what we think. And, you know, as you can imagine, as a writer, I tend to read all the time, you know, and I didn't know that my kids now read, you know. It's like, and they call it that high print household, where a lot of people, if they don't model simple things like reading, the kids aren't going to pick it up. When it comes to physical activity, you know, my wife is a runner, you know, and our household is, because one of those things where Liam is still a runner. Devin, my oldest, runs, but he does a lot of other stuff. But I think when you model actually these lifelong habits, I think if we were smokers, our kids would probably pick up smoking. It's just the way it is. So, mm-hmm. I think that if we can model things like running, and you don't need to say to a kid, you need to go run, they'll pick it up on their own if they want to at some point. And that's one of the great things about coaching as well. When I teach these kids to run fast, I'm also teaching kids to run for the rest of their life. The country club sports like golf and tennis are still the sport that people use to socialize, but more and more people socialize with running. It's the biggest participatory sport in the world. So when I take a kid who's 14 years old, who's never run before, and then I've got girls who have come back years later, they're married, they have children, but they still run. And it makes me feel so good. They're not competing. They might do a 5K or a half marathon, but more importantly, running is their go-to for physical activity. It's pretty cool.
And what is the saying, the mantra that you give your students? It's like on the back of their race shirt. I even saw a picture.
Oh, the keep pushing always?
Yeah. How'd you come up with that?
Keep pushing always.
It's a mixture of David Livingston, the African explorer, who basically his thing was bash on regardless. And then
very British.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, and then Springsteen says, keep pushing till it's understood in the song Badlands. So I kind of combined the two. It's a real simple thing, but now I'll say it every now and then, but sometimes they'll mock me with it. They'll say, hey, let's do 5 times 1,000, with 3 minutes rest. They'll go, oh, right, keep pushing always, huh, coach? Yeah. They can flip it off. It's very inspirational, but it's also a little bit of an inside joke at this point after 15 years.
Okay, I got to nerd out for a second and ask you about David Livingston, since you've written a book about him. David Livingston, first European to cross Africa on foot, right?
Right.
Okay, and discovered Victoria Falls.
Discovered Victoria Falls on the Zambezi River, yep.
And then Stanley, being enthralled by Livingston, this living legend, goes to find Livingston, and did he actually indeed say, Dr. Livingston, I presume?
I actually don't think so. Okay. I've seen Stanley's actual journals, and Stanley was somebody who had a deep inferiority complex, and so when he wrote his missives back to the New York Herald Tribune, he wanted to put something profound in there like that. But if you go to his journals, which describe every moment every aspect of the meeting with Livingston, which took place on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, the part about where he should have said Dr. Livingston, I presume, which would be this iconic scrap of paper, is torn out. It does not exist. So I don't think he said it.
Livingston survived a lion attack. Was paralyzed on one side of his body, or is his arm?
One arm. I think it was his right, but not completely paralyzed. He could still use it, but it was, but the lion literally took him in his mouth and shook him like a rag doll.
So as you have researched and have written about these explorers and adventurists, do you kind of see like a parallel between what our listeners and what we kind of do as endurance runners? Are there like lessons that we can learn from a Livingston? I don't think he ever ran. Not very many people did back then, but
life was so hard.
But
that he
was, it was like an endurance athlete in a way though, wasn't he?
No, he was. He actually, at the start of one of his expeditions, he actually wrote in his journal about the process of after 3 or 4 days of solid trekking, how the muscles became closely knit. And I think that was the term he used. And, everything, there was more of a spring in his step, and he felt better physically. So, I think the easy translation, we could go through all the traits of the great explorers, like, curiosity, hope, independence, self-mastery. Those are all traits of a great runner as well. But I think the simple thing that we all think of, it's just that thing about just keeping one foot in front of the other. People like Livingston, they went into, you think about it, you're going alone into the center of Africa at a time when there was no easy communication to get back out. There was no easy way to get rescued if something went horribly wrong. And yet they chose to keep going forward, whereas the sane person would not even begin the journey at all. And you think about that first marathon, the sane person does not say, I aspire to run 26.2 miles with 30,000 strangers, But what happens, you get the bug, you do a 5K, you do a 10K, you do a half marathon, which feels like the outer edges of the galaxy. Then you do it, and all of a sudden, that second half marathon doesn't feel like it's so much out there. But there's going to get to a point in that race where you're going to go, I'm done, I'm cooked. If there was a car to take you away, you would probably get in the car and go. But that's the rational thing to do. But what runners do is they keep putting one foot in front of the other. And they even they have that conversation with themselves all the time. We've all done it. You get to that point where everything hurts. You know, your hip flexors are on fire. You know, nothing's working. And you have the conversations like, I could stop. I could stop right now. Like, nobody would judge me. I have a million excuses that would work. But instead you say, well, I'm going to go to the next tree. You know, I'm going to put one foot in front of the other. I'm going to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And that's why when we cross the finish line, it is such a glorious feeling. If you stand at the finish line of any major marathon, even a 5K or a 10K, nobody crosses the finish line with an unhappy look on their face. Everybody is completely thrilled. I mean, it's just the most uplifting thing to do. And is why we do it, right?
Yeah. I just smile because crossing the finish line means I get to go sit down, have a beer.
Well, people smile even just for the fact that it's over, you know, sometimes.
They don't have anymore. But Disneyland, which is just up the road from me, used to have they had a series of great races. And, you know, they would be themed. You know, there was like the Tinkerbell race. They had all sorts of races.
Star Wars,
yeah. And my wife liked to do them. And I don't like pavement races. I'm very much a trail guy. So I would go watch. And I would watch her start. I would go get breakfast. And then I would go to the finish line and watch the finish. And literally just watching people, the things that people, just the exaltation, you know, their families, they're cheering them on, taking pictures, and that look on their face like they did something they didn't think they can do. I think that is, I would get a little misty. I cry about anything, but that would always get me a little misty just watching that.
For sure. Toward the beginning of the book, you talked about a Disney race that you did back in the day and they mismeasured the course, right?
Yeah, I'm still bitter about that. No, what happened was it was the one and only Disneyland Marathon. They had the Disney World Marathon. But the Disneyland Marathon took place, I think it was March 96. And here's why I was bitter. Because I hadn't broken 3 hours since I was 17 years old. It was I was 33 at the time. And we started, and it was supposed to be two 13.1-mile loops. And it went through the park, but it also went out of the park. And so we came through the first time. And then for some reason, they decided to measure the course like while the race was in progress, and they rerouted us. And I swear I went through 24 miles in 2:44, but my pace wasn't falling, and I was like so happy, like I'm gonna break three, it's gonna be amazing. Because prior to that I'd gone 3:01:48 at LA the previous year. I'd gone 3:01:51 at New York, so I needed that sub three. And next thing you know, they're rerouting this thing, and it seemed like it took forever. The last 2 miles always seem like they take forever, but this time, because in addition to one just wanting to finish, the Santa Ana winds were blowing. I was chafing horribly. So you kind of get that, the feeling.
Yes.
And I finally get done. It was like 3:01:50 or something like that.
Did you ever hear, did they make a mistake on the course measurement?
I don't know what happened, but you know what? And I was not the only one who thought that, so it was not just sour grapes on my part. And here's the thing. I mentioned that it came up in conversation the other day with a friend of mine. She just ran the Tokyo Marathon. We were talking about, bad marathons, and I mentioned that. And she goes, yeah, that's the one that they remeasured in the middle of the race. I heard it was really long. It's like, thank you for saying that. So
validate that.
Well, validated, right?
So, so kind of jumping around here, but I've got to ask you about this. What is it like to run with the bulls?
Yeah, I don't think we've ever had a guest who has run with the bulls before, so it's pretty awesome.
I got to tell you, you should do it. It is so cool.
Oh, he's already been talking about it since he's read the book. I'm like, oh, great.
Is it more of an honor if a bull, like, gores you a couple times during the run? Or
no. I think you're stupid.
Okay. Slow.
You're slow, right? But I think people, I was with a group, I got lucky enough to be with a group that was just right at the front of the pack. And you've got a half mile of people behind you. So you want to run fast so you don't get trampled. But with the bulls coming, but I think some people actually stay behind to taunt the bulls. And like I mentioned in the story, people have been, Pamplona is not, it's a religious festival, but it is not a religious experience. People are drinking and partying right up until the time. So the cobblestones are slick with urine and spilled wine and all sorts of stuff. So I think the people who, get between themselves and a bull, the people who choose to be there. But that moment when you run into the arena, and you literally, it's a bullfighting arena, but and it's filled with, like 1,000 or 10,000, I'm not sure the size, but it's all these people, all the residents of Pamplona watching the people come into the ring. And it's glorious. You know, and I used to always fantasize that, you know, that moment that Olympic marathoners have where they've run the marathon outside the stadium, but then they go through the tunnel and they're in the Olympic stadium and people burst into applause. In a very small scale, that's what that feels like. And it's an amazing moment. Mm-hmm. It's super cool. You should do it.
How many kilometers long is the race?
The run for Bulls? I think I ran about 600 meters. It's not that far because the whole length from where they release the Bulls into the stadium is not more than like 3 minutes of running for the Bulls.
It just feels longer because you're looking over your shoulder, like trying to think if you hear the Bulls or not.
So the people have a head start.
No, we all go at the same time. So just imagine a long winding street, and about 400 or 500 meters from the arena, they have a line of policemen who everybody behind the policemen is all the runners plus the Bulls. Everybody in front is pushed off the course, so there is a clear path into the arena. So you have to sprint foil just to get free of that. But the Bulls go at the same time as the people, so you want to keep moving.
So it sounds like you managed to stay ahead of the Bulls the whole time.
I did, but I kind of felt like if I really wanted to tempt fate, I would have not started with that front group. I would have kind of hung back a little bit more by where the Bulls are released. But at the same time, then the Bulls just kind of sweep past you. Then you're just trying to get into the arena at some point. So, but it's, you know, when I was standing in the middle of the arena, what the Bulls do is they come in and then those are the Bulls for that night's bullfight. So they push them through the arena into a holding pen on the other side. But as I was kind of standing there basking in the glory of all these thousands of people cheering, one of the Bulls kind of lined me up, and all of a sudden I realized he was sprinting right at me. And I literally ran. I jumped over the red wall that separates the arena from the spectators, landed on top of two policemen, and they picked me up and threw me bodily from the arena. So that was my goodness, Pamplona. So it's pretty cool.
So they were not happy with you landing on them.
No, they didn't take it well.
They just physically ejected you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great story. Did you see very many women running it?
Yeah, it's 50-50. I mean, and it's people of all ages and all levels of fitness. It's like I said, it's a party. And people who are obviously intoxicated, they take them out. But the people who are left are, you know, they're pretty serious about running with the Bulls. It's 7 o'clock in the morning too, so you better want to be there.
Well, it's been great speaking with you, Martin. Everyone go and check out the book, To Be a Runner. And if people want to find out more, where can we send them?
Gosh, I think it's going to be for sale on, you know, Amazon and all your local bookstores. If you haven't, checked out my website too, martindugard.com. There'll be information there about where they can purchase the book.
Sounds good.
Thanks for having me. It's really great.
One final question. You mentioned that you just finished up writing a book. Can you give us a sneak peek in what it was?
Yeah, it's the ninth killing book. We haven't released the title yet. So
who has to die now?
We've already all died.
we've got one more. We're contractually obligated for one more. So I think the series may end at 10. I'm not sure if we're going to keep going. But now that we have a break here, I'm actually working on a book of my own right now. And it's actually fiction. And it's a running related fiction story about World War II. So,
oh, wow. That sounds awesome.
It'll be like my spring break between killing books, you know, to kind of go into the world of fiction and play around for a while.
Sounds amazing.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Hey, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, Trevor and Angie back. We're still in the hotel room in Iceland. We haven't gone anywhere. Big thanks to Martin for letting us interview him. Again, the book is called To Be a Runner, and if you want to check it out, we'll have a link on our website. We do want to answer one question that we got from our MTA Facebook page, and it's all about what does a person have to do if they want to run their first marathon next year? So that'll be 2020. Before we bring you guys that, though, we do want to thank this episode's sponsor, Tiger Balm. It's a great product for muscle relief, so you don't have to let muscle aches and pains stop you. You can apply Tiger Balm Active before or after a workout.
That's right. Tiger Balm Active has 3 pain relief products. They've got the Muscle Rub, which is a non-greasy pre-workout warming cream that gets sore muscles ready to go for peak performance. They have something else called the Muscle Gel, which is a non-sticky, cool-to-warm gel that helps with muscle fatigue, perfect for post-workout cool-down, something that would have been great right after the marathon or the day after the marathon, for sure. And then they have the Tiger Balm Active Muscle Spray, which helps relieve pain in those hard-to-reach areas. We all know that with long-distance running, sometimes pain happens, but suffering is optional. So start using Tiger Balm Active. You can pick it up today at your local CVS or Rite Aid store.
Tiger Balm Active. Pick it up at your local CVS or Rite Aid store. That's Tiger Balm Active. All right, so Angie, I know you like to thoroughly prepare for the podcast and have time to think about an answer, but just shooting from the hip, as they say, from the hotel room in Reykjavik, what does a person have to do to successfully run a marathon in 2020?
Yeah, this question came from John. He says, hello, I'm very new to running. I would really like to train to run a marathon in 2020. Can you please advise me how you might be able to help me achieve this? So yeah, that's a great question, John. And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who are thinking 2020 is going to be the year that they take on their first marathon or, of course, half marathon. And so really, starting now is super important because what you need to be doing in the next few months is building up a solid running base. You don't want to get to the end of 2019 and think, oh no, I haven't started training and I need to rush and hurry it up, because as you'll hear on this podcast over and over, we are in the business of trying to prevent injuries.
That's right.
And trying to cram for a marathon is one of the number one ways to get injured. So we want to prevent that.
And Angie, I've heard you say that a running base typically is running 3 miles at a time consistently for about 3 to 6 months.
It depends on the person and their fitness level going into running, of course. If they've been running, you know, shorter distances right along, then they might need a shorter buildup. But yeah, you need to get to the place where you can run 3 to 5 miles at a time, 3 times a week for 4 to 6 months minimum, before you decide to take on the marathon training. And then, of course, your marathon plans will vary anywhere from 16 to 20 weeks typically. So, you know, starting now is a great place. Just build up to that 3 to 5 mile distance 3 times a week. And, you know, at first, a lot of people will want to do the run-walk method, which is a great way to build up your distance. You don't have to be able to run the 3 to 5 miles without stopping. You know, some people like to approach their training through a run-walk method, and that's totally fine. The key is to keep the training runs nice and easy. You're working on building up endurance, not setting speed records. So make sure that you're not killing yourself every time you go out there. Build up that endurance and also start integrating cross training into your routine right now, so that when you get into that marathon training plan, it's not something new that you're starting as well. So I really recommend that people get in a habit of doing core and strength training to build up those accessory muscles, to help support your joints, and really help to build you into a stronger runner. And of course, there's other great cross-training exercises that you can do as well. There's things like yoga, Pilates, cycling, swimming, cross-country skiing. I mean, rowing, the sky's the limit kind of thing. But definitely a minimum of doing some core and strength training into your weekly schedule. And then make sure that you're getting good sleep and, you know, focusing on your nutrition, because the healthier your body, the healthier runner that you'll be.
All right. Well said, Angie. And I guess we might as well mention shoes, because we have been asked a lot of times by newbies about, well, what kind of shoe should I get? And there's really no right answer to that, because there's tons of great running shoes out there, probably some that you've never even heard of. And the key is to, I think, if you're starting out, go to a specialty running store and see what they recommend you to wear. Sometimes they will even give you a gait evaluation by having you run on a treadmill and see how your foot is landing and put you in the right shoe based on that.
Yeah, make sure that you're able to walk around or even, you know, run a little bit in the shoe in the store. And it's also helpful to shop for running shoes in the afternoon or evening when your foot has had a chance to swell, because you don't want to buy your running shoes too small. I find a lot of people buy shoes that start cramping their toes. You start running, your foot will start swelling. So make sure that it's adequate size and that it really feels comfortable. And of course, we have a lot of great blog posts over on our website for beginners. And we also offer half marathon plans and marathon plans. And for some people, you know, getting the help of a running coach is going to be a great way to build up to that marathon distance. So there's a lot of great ways to approach the marathon. And now is the time to get started for 2020.
All right, John. So there you go. Build that base. Do some cross training accordingly. Pick out the marathon and get yourself a good marathon training plan, and of course, shoes that fit you well. And remember that you have what it takes. and reach out to us if you need more help. That's what we're here for. All right, so that's episode 282. Thank you guys for letting us do kind of a little unconventional episode here. And of course, our next episode will be recapping the London Marathon and telling you all about that and things that we learned along the way and how we did. Kind of tie a bow on two episodes ago where we talked about how we were training for that. So we'll see, you know, how that paid off or didn't pay off. You'll have to wait to find out. We actually came through Iceland on our way to the London Marathon. Didn't stay the night. We were just in the airport. I bought some, like, fish jerky. That is how we began these 7 days together. Angie, what'd you think about that?
You're lucky I stuck with you the rest of the way.
Well, I was really hungry, and it tastes great, but you would always walk away from me when I started digging into it.
You could clear a room with that stuff.
Yes, yes. It's all good. All right, guys, that's it. If you want to send us a question or a comment, you can do that through Facebook. We're over at Marathon Academy. We're also on Instagram at Marathon Academy. And our website is, of course, marathontrainingacademy.com. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you'll know when a new episode is being released. They usually release about every 10 days. Until next time, remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Right on my way. Oh, wait.